Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more, discussing important topics in higher education, research, student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Dr. T. Michael Parrish, the Lyndon G. Bowers Professor of American History at Baylor, the author of numerous books, and an expert in 19th century U.S. history. Dr. Parrish recently co-authored the book Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor, and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement with history professor Thomas R. Cottrer. The book examines the life and impact of the Waco native and World War II hero Doris Miller, whose bravery on the USS West Virginia during the attack on Pearl Harbor resonates to the present day in a number of ways, which we will discuss. The first phase of a Doris Miller memorial just north of downtown Waco along the Brazos River was dedicated in December, and Dr. Parrish and a number of people throughout Baylor and certainly across the community played a big role in that happening. Dr. Parrish, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Derek, for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, obviously, the memorial was dedicated locally in Waco in December, but when you think about our appreciation of Doris Miller, both locally and nationally, what's special about this moment in time and our appreciation of him, and what role did the development of this memorial have on your broader project, the book that we're going to discuss?
Yeah, well, the project to construct and dedicate the memorial began a number of years back, and it involved people here at Baylor, like Professor Jerry Powell in the law school, and various community leaders. It really was an opportunity for the community to come together in a common purpose to celebrate and recognize and establish a permanent presence for the legacy of Doris Miller here in the community. It was very, very fulfilling to participate in the project from the very beginning. I decided about 4 years ago to contribute my expertise by writing, researching and writing publishing a book on Doris Miller. No biography of him, remarkably, had ever been done. And so I enlisted an old friend of mine, Tom Cottrer, who had recently retired from Arizona State University and had some time to work on this project. He readily agreed to do it. And so we began the process of trying to find as much material on Doris Miller as we possibly could.
And the result is the book Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor, and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement. So let's dive into the book. For people who don't know, who was Doris Miller? He's a Waco native and a World War II hero, but tell us a little about him.
Yeah, Doris Miller was a very, very ordinary person from an ordinary family who at Pearl Harbor was finally thrust into an extraordinary situation and performed a great heroic act. He grew up in a poor sharecropping family just outside of Waco in the community of Spiegelville. His family were cotton farmers, and as sharecroppers, they had very, very meager financial income. As a youth and teenager, Doris Miller worked in Waco at local restaurants in the kitchens, trying to make as much money as he could to support his family. He was a expert marksman. He knew how to use a rifle. He sometimes went hunting in the woods. But before he left school to join the Navy, he showed that he had a tremendous physical strength and ability. He was a star football player on the A.J. Moore Academy football team. He also learned how to box. He was a great boxer. He finally decided that he wanted to leave school and join the military, join the Navy, to try to make some money to send back home to help his family.
What was his role in the Navy, and what was life like in the Navy in the 1940s for African Americans?
Well, unfortunately, in the Navy, life for African Americans and any naval personnel of color, life was very, very difficult. In fact, of all the armed services, the Navy treated black sailors especially worse than any other branch of the military, confined to the worst kinds of jobs on board. But he performed his duties as a messman, that is, mainly working in the kitchen, serving food, cleaning up, in a dutiful way. He never complained. He was relatively modest. He was patriotic, too. He believed what he was doing was serving a selfless and far greater purpose. And so he maintained an optimistic spirit throughout that experience in the Navy.
So eventually he was stationed in Hawaii, and the events on Pearl Harbor are why we know him today. Take us through his actions December 7th, 1941.
Yeah, he had been in the Navy for more than 2 years in December of 1941, and so he was relatively seasoned, and he was prepared better than most people at Pearl Harbor at the time were prepared for the Japanese attack. He had a battle station. He helped a gunnery crew, an anti-aircraft gunnery crew, handle and load ammunition. And so when the Japanese attacked in the early morning hours of December 7th, he was already awake, and you know, he was collecting laundry and getting ready for a full day of duty on board ship, even though it was Sunday. And when the bombs began to fall and the torpedoes began to strike the West Virginia, the battleship that he was on, he went to his battle station and discovered that the anti-aircraft gun had been knocked out. And so an officer, a junior officer who was nearby, ordered him to come to the bridge and to help him move the ship's captain, Mervyn Binion, who had been wounded and, in fact, mortally wounded, move the captain to a safer position that was less vulnerable to the bombing and the machine gun fire. By this time, the West Virginia was sinking. It was listing badly to one side. Countermeasures were taken to flood part of the ship in order to try to right it and straighten it up. Flames were almost everywhere, all over the ship, and this was true of all the ships that had been struck at Pearl Harbor. Lots of smoke and lots of fires, and a very, very perilous situation. Lots of sailors were jumping overboard. The ship's captain tried to countermand orders for sailors to jump overboard. So he was still issuing orders, although he was very, very badly wounded. And so Doris Miller and another officer moved him from the bridge down to the main deck to a safer position. And that in itself was an act of great heroism, because the Japanese were continuing to attack. There was lots of machine gun fire from Japanese planes. But then events began to take a truly remarkable turn, because once the captain was in a safer position, Doris Miller and the other officer noticed that there were a couple of 50-caliber anti-aircraft machine guns nearby. And the officer, and so Doris Miller just took it upon himself to man one of the machine guns, which was very, very surprising to the officer. And the officer was concerned that Doris Miller wouldn't know how to fire it, but in fact he started firing immediately. And he fired the gun for about 15 minutes, and was quite impressive in the way that he used the gun.
Well, and what was the impact of his actions on that day, starting just in the battle itself and then trickling out much further than that, obviously?
The impact was, for a long time, very, very disputed. He fired it at Japanese airplanes, but Tom Cotrera and I determined that almost certainly he did not shoot down a single airplane. We did painstaking research on this, and the forensic evidence is just very, very clear. He may have hit one plane. And so it's very, very interesting how historical memory works. You know, we tend to exaggerate very, very often the things that we remember, the things that we see. And so the stories, the rumors began to circulate of this. The long-range impact was... much more important. The point we make in the book is that he was extremely cool, extremely determined, extremely courageous under very, very difficult conditions in mortal combat. That's what's most important. And what happened was the African American press in the North, in America at the time, picked up on the rumors of Doris Miller showing great heroism and allegedly shooting down Japanese planes at Pearl Harbor. And so they pressed immediately have the Navy Department reveal his name. Initially, the Navy Department was very reluctant to do more than just admit that, yes, there had been a black sailor who showed heroism at Pearl Harbor. But then finally, the Navy Department relented and released Doris Miller's name. And the black press, along with politicians in the North, began to put pressure on Congress to not only honor Doris Miller, but to give him the Congressional Medal of Honor. The Navy Department was reluctant to give him any award, but it finally relented when members of Congress actually contacted the Roosevelt administration. They went directly to the White House. And, Franklin Roosevelt got involved. And so he was very, very supportive of honoring Doris Miller with the award that he ultimately received, which was the Navy Cross.
Well, and the impact, obviously, of Doris Miller went far beyond that long term. Yeah. What are some of the ways his act of heroism changed things in the Navy and, in turn, Dr. Parrish, started moving things towards the golden era of the Civil Rights Movement?
Yeah. United States wars throughout American history have been opportunities to press for full civil rights and all the rights of citizenship, and more than that, full social and political equality and opportunities for leadership. African American press, together with the NAACP, were determined to capitalize on Doris Miller's notoriety as much as they possibly could in order to advance the ongoing cause of civil rights. Historians like to talk about the long civil rights movement, which began all the way back in the colonial era and emerged certainly during all of America's wars, notably the American Revolution, the Civil War, about 200,000 black troops serving in the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, again, black troops offering service, serving heroically, and certainly again in World War II. And so World War I. And so World War II offered the opportunity once again for African Americans to press for full equality in the military as a means to achieve full equality politically and in society. And so on the home front during World War II, African Americans launched what they called the Double V campaign. Victory abroad over Nazi and Japanese tyranny, but also victory at home over racism, discrimination, persecution, and violence against African Americans. So Doris Miller was very integral in pushing forward this civil rights movement during World War II that then led on to the larger, wider, more impactful civil rights movement of the 1950s and the crescendo that we recognize and emphasize so much during the 1960s. The military came under great pressure to desegregate once and for all, to open up the military for African Americans. And so Doris Miller became involved in helping that effort on the home front when he was brought home. That was another cry, bring Doris Miller home, take him on tour, do the same thing that other heroes were doing, help raise war bonds, help recruiting, but more than that, in Doris Miller's case, to help accomplish the desegregation of the Navy by working to open up opportunities for African Americans, and he did that very thing. African Americans were soon being trained for higher positions. This led to African Americans to become officers and to eventually be recruited and admitted and trained in the military service academies. And then finally for President Harry Truman, who succeeded Franklin Roosevelt, to issue an executive order to desegregate all of the military services once and for all. And that's what really set the stage for the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Let me say this, too, that every time a civil rights leader in the late 1940s and 1950s and 1960s talked about the great military service of African Americans throughout American history in all American wars, invariably, they brought Doris Miller's name forward. They pointed directly to him, not only as a hero, but as a real catalyst to the ongoing civil rights movement and the success that it achieved.
Of course, he didn't live to get to see that, unfortunately. Lost his life at the age of 24.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, in 1943, in November, at Tarawa, during the island hopping campaign in the Pacific that led to the end of the war, eventually he was on board a baby aircraft carrier, which was carrying not only airplanes but also lots of munitions, lots of fuel oil, and it only took one Japanese torpedo to sink the ship, and over 600 sailors lost their lives out of a crew of about 900. And Doris Miller's life was lost. He was missing in action and presumed dead. Let me say this too. Doris Miller was prepared to provide leadership to the civil rights movement had he lived. And in fact, he talked about it. He said, I want to do my part. Although when he was brought home to go on tour, he did so kind of reluctantly. He gained confidence. He could speak in public. He was always very impressive because he had great conviction. If he had lived, he would have become not only an icon of the civil rights movement, he probably would have become a leader.
Well, we're sorry we didn't get to see that part of his life, but certainly what he did, as you've painted that picture, has resonated to this day. For people who might have joined in the middle of the program, Dr. Parrish, as we wind down, for people who visit the Doris Miller Memorial here in Waco, if you had to sum up in just a few sentences what his legacy truly was, what would you say?
Yeah. Well, his legacy was huge and permanent. And that sort of sums up what we hope this memorial will accomplish. We want his not only his image, but his story and his impact and his influence to become even greater and to become even more permanent. That was really the main purpose of the monument, the statue, together with the monument. And I hope that it will receive widespread attention, widespread attendance for many, many, many years to come.
Just a few long touchdown throws down the street from McLean Stadium, right? Down MLK. If people would like to visit before or after a game or when they're visiting campus, it's on MLK just north of the river near the Bledsoe Miller Recreation Center.
And let me add this, too. If you'd like to contribute to the achievement of Phase 3 of the memorial, just go on the Internet, DorisMillerMemorial.org. Just Google that, DorisMillerMemorial.org, and you can make a contribution of any amount very, very easily. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Parrish. Thank you for sharing that. And again, your book, Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement. It is available. You can find that online at a number of outlets. And we appreciate you taking the time to join us on Baylor Connections today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor to be here. I enjoyed it.
Dr. T. Michael Parrish, the Lyndon G. Bowers Professor of American History at Baylor, our guest today. I'm Derek Smith. Thanks for joining us on Baylor Connections.